now you can. Maybe people do.
It's recording.
Okay. Good morning. We'll start our meeting. We are expecting Karen Brewington in a few minutes. So we'll open the February 21st Sussex County Council Pension Committee meeting. And the first thing, everybody have an agenda? We do have a few items to discuss today. The approval of the minutes, our quarterly investment analysis, and Mr. John Lessel from Aon, our actuaries, here today, so we can talk about assumptions and anything that's actuary-related, and then some goals for 2013 and anything else we need to discuss. So the first order of business is I need a motion to approve the November 7th minutes.
So moved.
Okay, second?
Second.
I got a motion and a second to approve the November 7th minutes. Mr. James?
Yes.
Mr. Lawson?
Yes.
Mr. Leahy?
Yes.
And Mr. Baker?
Yes.
And I say yes. Motion passed to approve the November 7th minutes. All right, Mr. Schoen will give us a quarterly report, and this is for second quarter of our fiscal year, but fourth quarter of the calendar year.
That's correct. Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It was nice to take a 15-minute drive over to the meeting instead of, actually, I had an appointment in D.C. that ended at about 5 o'clock last night, so I just came across the Bay Bridge, stayed in Lewis for the evening, and came on over. So, and yet, as Susie noticed, I was not as prompt as I normally am. So.
It was later.
Yes.
Closer.
Yes. Well, what happens is you start doing some work, and you get caught up on phone calls, and, well, you know how that works. So, so what we want to do is talk about the performance report, the performance of both the funds, for the year and for the quarter, and then we're also going to talk about investment policy and investment guidelines for your fixed income manager. Okay. So you'll also see within there.
I didn't know if there was one extra report that Mr. Lessel could have since we do.
There you go.
Okay, thank you. Linda's not here. That's all.
Okay. And also what you see in there is some updates. So you'll see an update through the end of January. You'll see some information that will be pertinent to our discussion on the guidelines for when we can trust fixed income portfolios for both of the funds. And then you'll see our newsletter. Okay. So if you go actually into the bound part and go under the first tab, talking about market environment. Last year, the equity markets were very strong. The first half of the year, the U.S. outperformed international, and then for the second half of the year, the international outperformed the domestic. Fixed income returns, for the most part, were positive, but very small, as one might expect. But actually, a little bit better than we had expected. We thought maybe that interest rates would start climbing, and they didn't, although this year we're starting to see some negative returns on fixed income, which is what we've been talking about the last several meetings. If you turn to, actually, to the page 3 of the report, you actually see some numbers in there to put a little more meat onto that. In the upper left-hand corner, you'll see on the far left-hand side, the light blue where it says 0.2 was the U.S. market. So the U.S. markets for the fourth quarter were barely positive. Yet the international, which you see in the gray color, was up 6.6, and emerging markets, which would be all international markets, not including emerging markets, including emerging markets, was 5.6. You also see that on the bonds, which are the next three to the side of that, are you see a 0.2, you see a 2.7, and a 3.4. The negative 2.7 was emerging market debt. So that's an area that had done well earlier on, but then fell off in the fourth quarter. But for the total year, what you'll see, and you'll see those double-digit returns are all equity markets very strong, much greater than most of us had expected. And that's why you'll see returns for the year that are better than your actuarial assumed rate of returns. Second thing you'll notice is that, for the first half of the year, growth stocks did better than value stocks. For the second half of the year, actually value, which is the blue, and this is the second rectangle, you'll see the blue area, which are the value stocks, outperformed the growth stocks. And you can see the lighter blue, the lighter it is, the smaller the size company did better than the large company stocks. Okay, so you see a 3.9, that's mid-cap value, 3.2 is small-cap value. And that was a benefit to yourselves because your portfolio is designed to have a little bit of a value tilt to it. You know, we've talked about for several years that value typically, not all the times, but typically is better in the down markets, does almost as well in the up markets as growth. And so noting your conservative nature, you lean and have your portfolio structured to have more to that area. And that was a benefit to your plan. For the year, you also see, and that's to the right of that rectangle, that all the blues are above the reds. Again, for the whole year, value outperformed growth. If you recall, the first half of the year last year, growth was ahead, but there was enough value surged ahead enough in second half of the year and fourth quarter, most specifically, to capture that. Okay. Now, to go on to page 4, and we'll wrap up on some of this market environment going on. If you look at the top graph, it's the U.S. Treasury yield curve. And the blue is the yield curve at the end of third quarter. The gray is the yield curve at the end of the fourth quarter. You can see it has all shifted up. And I should note, on the far right-hand side are long-term bonds. The far left-hand side are short-term bonds. So you work your way across from short to long, coming left to right. But all the way across that yield curve, you saw interest rates go up, not a lot, but a little bit. And that's reflected, if you look at the graph below that, the fourth quarter returns, basically all returns on fixed income were either flat or a little further out, or even slightly negative. And that trend has continued on so far this quarter, that returns on fixed income have turned negative. Now, a little later on, there'll be discussion by your actuary on the assumed rate of returns and other issues like that. But, and I don't mean to put words in your mouth, so please correct anything that I might say here. But generally, when an actuary sets a return assumption, they look at your asset allocation mix. They look at long-term expected returns on your asset classes, you know, equities and fixed income. They look at your, as you say, your allocation mix, and then they say what is a reasonable long-term expected return you can have. And long-term fixed income does about 5.25% return. So if you take, you know, roughly 40% of that, you take 60% of stocks, which over time do 10 to 10.25%, you blend the two of those together. Well, I'm not sure you even get to 8%, but you get a little, at least close to that. But if yields on bonds, and we've talked about this before, if yields on bonds, you know, you look at a 10-year bond and a treasury is yielding, as looked earlier today, was about 1.5%. What are you going to get over the next 10 years on bonds? I don't think you're going to get 5 to 5.25. So it does get back to this issue that we've talked about before of, you know, either you have to do some changes to your portfolio mix and or change some of your assumptions. And I think that's one of the things, as we talked about, and maybe a combination of both of those. So, okay.
Do you, sure. Just a question, interesting observation. Do you think investors are foregoing some safety for the higher return with the high yield bonds?
Yes.
That's the only place it is, especially on a fixed income.
Yeah, that's
very interesting because of the economy and how it was that they're really risking just for that return.
Yes, my concern is that even though there's a need to always try to get the, and I'll use the term best return, not necessarily highest return, because shooting for the highest return means you may take undue
right.
risk. What is happening is there are investors that are chasing yield.
Yeah.
And we see that not only on the fixed income side, especially the high yield bonds, which there's been a great surge in returns there, But high yield, remember, the credit quality is not as good. And high yield bonds perform as much like stocks as they do like bonds. And in 2008, high yield bonds were down about 20%. So they weren't a good, you know, people go into bonds because they think it's a good protection when the stock market goes down. But if you go into the wrong types of bonds, you know, mortgages didn't do well then either, but it was high yield that actually got hit the hardest, the corporate bonds, and the lower quality corporate bonds. So it's a very good point. We're also seeing that on the equity side, that there's last year, the higher dividend stocks were the better performers because people were chasing yield, okay? And over time, I will tell you, the higher yielding, more dividend-oriented stocks actually do tend to do better. But so much went into that area. That now has been the area that has had the lower returns in the equities because it might have gone up too high and then it's you know, balancing back down now. So as I say, there's that fine line of trying to get more returns but not taking on undue risk to do that. Okay. Any other questions about okay. I will tell you, being in D.C. yesterday, they started asking me about the impact of the sequestration. And I said, well, you tell me what's going to come out of that and what the politicians are going to decide, then I might be able to guess what the impact will be. That's these things, you know, we had the fiscal cliff. Everybody was scared about the fiscal cliff. You know, people said, take your money out of stocks. Well, what happened? Stocks have done the best of any, you know, last year and this quarter. So I think the discipline process you have, that you set your long-term strategy, you always need to go back and look and say, okay, is that strategy appropriate a couple years later? But based upon your long-term strategy, you stick to that. You don't get overly, you know, emotional about, hey, what's going to happen next quarter, next month, and so on and so forth. You stick with your discipline. I think that's served you well. Okay. You go to the next tab. We look at the fund specifically. Okay, this will be page 8. So we're going to start with the pension fund. You had an investment return in fourth quarter of $237,000. That was a return of 0.73% gross and 0.66% net. Okay. For 2012, you had a return of $3.8 million. And when I say net, that's net of all the management fees. Okay. Not necessarily net of custodial fees or actuaries or consulting, but all your investment manager fees. So it's a net investment return. That's a 10% gross return and 9.7% net return. Okay. So I will tell you that, you know, obviously that's above your actuarial assumed rate of return. To the degree you can beat your 8% on net, that improves the funded status of your plan and lowers your ARCs. I'll also tell you it's one of the lower returns of our client base, but would be expected also, because I'd say of all of our clients, you are the most conservatively invested. When markets are doing very well, you will lag, okay? But you're still positive. When markets go down, then you should be at the top, okay? Fortunately, since 2008, we haven't had to test that, you know? But Wilmington Trust had very strong returns versus their benchmark, but lagged most of the managers due to the constraints on them. Not when we compare them versus what they're supposed to be doing, they had a very, very good year. But because of the limitations you put in corporate stocks and other areas, you know, they lagged the average manager. Okay. Fidelity had very strong returns, although I didn't reference in here, DuPont had sort of average kind of returns relative to the benchmark. Okay. So they've done a good job for you. They haven't done lights out, but they've done a good job for you. Good consistency, and we'll look at that in a minute. And the state of Delaware, they were below their benchmark for the quarter and the year, but just for the 3 years, they're ahead. Do note, any fund, any manager is not going to outperform every single year. Right. So last year wasn't as good a year for them as they had in other years, but long term, it's a good, I think, as we've always discussed, it's a good, you know, to have part of your portfolio there. It gives you a good diversification of the plan your size couldn't access on your own. But they do also go into some investments that you probably wouldn't do on your own. You know, they have private equity. They do have hedge funds. They are more aggressive in their allocation mix. And that's why you take the rest of your portfolio and you're more conservative with it to sort of balance out what the state of Delaware is doing. As we've talked about before, the state of Delaware has more flexibility to tolerate more volatility and risk in their portfolio than a municipality would. What are the things we want you to look at going forward? One is the fixed income guidelines we've talked about. We'll get into a little bit more specificity in a minute on that. I just referenced actuarial assumptions, which I'll lead that into you. The area of LDI, liability-driven investing. Okay, we're not here to talk about that today, but it's become a topical issue. It's very topical for corporate America. Governments are beginning to talk about that. They're talking about primarily driven by the item you see below that, which is GASB 67 and 68, which deal with the pension right now, do not deal with OPEB. But if you follow the history of FASB and GASB, that not too distant future, similar if not exact kind of guidelines that are set out for the pension fund, I believe, will be set out for your retirement health benefit, your OPEB fund. And I think that's driving some of this discussion around liability-driven investing. And so today, I'm not here to talk about that, but just to say that I think at some other meeting, we should talk a little bit more on some of the things we're seeing out there, and does it apply to yourself? Does it make sense? But you're surely probably seeing some of this information out there. Or if you haven't, you will be.
While you're still on pension,
sure.
I'm trying to interrupt, I forwarded the article to you on the state of Delaware concern that they were their disclosure on their unfunded obligation or liability wasn't really what it was. Remember, they
yep.
were criticized for really having a larger unfunded liability because all the stuff that was in there. Any problems there? You know, they put that out there, and you know, our council knows that they're 33% of our portfolio, and
sure.
It just causes, you know, problems.
Sure. So really there's a couple issues there. One is the funded status of the state plan. The second issue, which would be more, I'll say more directly pertinent to yourself, is the investment pool, you know, and do they change the way they invest their investment pool because of their funded status?
Right.
Okay. Now, this gets to an issue that you could line up 10 people, and you're going to get 10 different opinions on this. So you're going to get one person's opinion on this. And you might even get a different opinion, John, or maybe something similar but not exactly the same. And all those opinions might be correct. They're just different views on the same issue. But when you look at the liability, you know, you look at all the future benefit payments. And then you have to discount those payments back to today to say, what is the present value liability? Now, there's several different measures of present value liability. I'll allow you to tackle that at one if you want to. But one of the big issues is, okay, when you discount that, meaning putting future obligations back into today's dollars, what is the interest rate or discount rate that you use to say what it's worth? For example, let's say you owe $100 now. Okay, that's one situation. The other is you owe $100 10 years from now, okay? So which one is a greater liability? Well, I would say the one that's owed today, because that's $100. You could invest your money so that 10 years from now you have that $100 to pay it off. So the question is, how much do you have to invest today to get to that $100? Well, that gets to all these issues as to part of what we're going to talk about is what kind of discount rate or interest rate or return assumption do you use? Okay. What does the accounting industry say that you have to use? What do the credit rating agencies say you have to use? Okay. And then this article, which basically was saying you had to use current bond yields. I would agree with the premise that there are a number of corporate plans and municipal plans that overstated their funded status, okay? However, I don't think I would use the very, very low rate of return. I forget who it was who wrote that article, but that they use. I think they use about 2%
treasury rate. Right.
And my opinion would be I wouldn't use that rate, okay? Somewhere, you know, so I is it important to know that there's liabilities out there and try to measure what they are? Yes. That's why the accounting industry has come out and set some very fairly rigorous guidelines of how to deal with that. Now, if that problem was as big as reported, then might the state invest more aggressively to try to catch up? Okay, under same thing as you said about, you know, people investing more in high yield because, wow, how do I make more return? If that was the case, then that's where the concern would rise as to how it impacts upon your plan.
Okay. Thank you.
So you get an economist to answer a question. It's never a word or two. Okay. And have people had some opportunity to?
I got it yesterday.
Yeah.
We've had some server issues on our own computer.
So. Okay. And we're always a little later with yours than others because getting information from the state takes so long. We can get to, and the reason why the state takes so long is they have a number of assets that are not as readily marketable. Some of the hedge funds and private equities. You should note that we did have to make a correction on the third quarter report because what was reported by the state had to have a correction on it. Now, what you got in fourth quarter was correct, so it didn't impact the amount of money that you have because you didn't take any money in or out of it. But there was
the value.
There was a valuation that the state had put at the end of third quarter that was off by, it was about $120,000, I think, or something like that. So just be aware of that. So that took some more time, too. That's why, you know, we just got it to you the last couple of days. So I think how I would boil things down here, if you turn to page 10 and 11. Okay, so 10 shows you that at the end of the year, you had $58.8 million. Your time-weighted return was 10%. Okay, you see your blended investment fees. Okay, I will tell you that for a fund your size, your average expense ratio is higher than most of our, you know, most of our clients of this size are more in the, about a third less than this. Most of that is because of the state pool is the expense ratio that it is. Most of the time, they make more than enough return to offset that expense ratio. This past year, they did not. You might say, well, why is the expense ratio of the state plan higher than what we see elsewhere? It's because of all these investments in private equity and hedge funds. Those have much more expensive, you know, expense ratios. And they have a slightly higher allocation to international stocks, which that also is a little bit more expensive also, but it's primarily the alternatives area. As I say, most of our clients of similar size, you're at 0.6, most of them are at about 0.4 to 0.38. So, okay.
Fidelity's high too.
Yeah, but Fidelity is small cap stock. And small cap stock is going to be, you know, between 0.75% to 1%. Okay, so I think DuPont gives you a very good price at 0.35 for equities. Wilmington Trust gives you a very good price at 0.2% for fixed income for a portfolio that size. But I don't find Fidelity's to be unreasonable based upon what they're doing. Okay, and I don't consider the states unreasonable based upon their use of alternatives. Okay, and most years, as I say, they do enough to overcome that cost disadvantage. This year, they did not.
So if others in a pool like this might have an expense rate of 0.38 or 0.4.
Mm-hmm.
How do they get similar returns as we might enjoy from the state of Delaware investment pool without being invested in that specific? Are there alternatives, in other words, that we should be considering?
Yes, or maybe over time, not necessarily. So let's talk about what I think the state of Delaware gives you. It gives you broad diversification into areas that you wouldn't necessarily go in. In fact, some of them you wouldn't go into, you know, because of the size of your plan, and maybe just by, you know, non-desire to be in the area of hedge funds and private equities and alternatives, okay? I will give you some idea. Our average client with a 60% allocation to equities was up about 11.7 last year, okay? So last year was not as good a year for you, and primarily because of the state. But there are other years, you know, I don't want to be bashing on a state, you know, for multiple reasons, but recognize that there are other years that they had very good years, okay? What most of them are doing is, first off, they're not, my clients of similar size, you know, even ones up to half a billion dollars, aren't using alternatives. So I think that's probably the biggest difference there, that's allowing it to be, you know, roughly a third of the price. So now, one of the things that maybe over time, instead of having, and you're about, I'll look at 60% in the state plan, but maybe eventually you allow it to drift down to 50%, and that'll help lower your expense ratio. But I still think it's a good pool, you know, and drifting down, meaning as you put more money in, you know, and as growth, then maybe that growth goes outside of that, you know, and that overall will help level things down. Okay. Just another point or two of this, and then I'll wrap up on this and get to the OPEB fund. On page 11, the upper right-hand corner. Actually, let's start in the upper left-hand corner. You can see both the red and the black rectangles. If you're above the line, that means you beat your policy index. The policy index being a 60-40, okay? You know, and you're actually 14% international stocks, 46% domestic, and then 40% fixed income. If you're above the line, it means you beat the policy index. If you're below the line, you lost to it. Notice that all the times in red, and that's when the stock market is down, that you beat your policy index. Okay? Most of the time, but not all the time, when the market's been positive, you've lost to the policy index. Okay? So starting with a conservative policy index, 60-40, it's not radically conservative, but it's fairly conservative. And then with the fixed income guidelines you have, which is even a little bit more conservative than the norm, you tend to, because of your lineup of managers and how you do things, you tend to then do, even relative to a conservative benchmark, in good times, you lose to that, and in good, bad times, you win to that, which is what you'd want, but you might be giving up a little too much in being, you might be a little too conservative. I hate to say that, especially in Sussex County. But I say that to Lancaster County, too, sometimes. So be mindful of that. The other thing is the on the right-hand side, you'll see this, you know, this rectangle. You'll see the blue. The way to read that is how you do in percentages in up and down markets. So that 100-100, that crosshair, that means in up markets, down markets, you're doing 100% of those markets, okay? The way you would read this is in up markets, you do about, go over to the left, and that's about 85%. So if the market was up 10, you were up about 8.5, okay? If you go straight down, that's about 70, let's say 72. So in down markets, you do about 72% of the market. So if the market was down 10, you're only down 7.2. So it's just another reconfirming that, you know, you do much better in the down markets, not as well in the up markets. I just think the thing you need to think about is, do you push it just a little bit? Maybe not, if you're exactly comfortable with where you are. But okay. I've talked about the managers. I don't think there's any changes I'd make on those. I just, you know, reference again that Wilmington Trust had a very, very good return. Part of what did that is that their benchmark is the government index. That means intermediate government. So it's intermediate maturity. Government means they can buy treasuries and agencies. But you also allow them to buy up to 25% in corporate stock, in corporate bonds, I mean. And they have gone to 25% corporates. And corporates have significantly outperformed government agencies, agencies and treasuries this past year. So they made some good tactical decision within the guidelines that were printed for them. And that's what added. Okay?
Should we stick with 25%?
Should we go to 50?
Well, that leads right into, okay. So at the last meeting, you asked me to talk to Wilmington Trust about, you know, should you loosen the guidelines a little bit, okay? Now, in there, you'll first see this with your color graph. Okay. Now, I say, well, so Michael, what's this? So over the last, since December 94 to December 12th, December of last year, so 19 years, you might say, why did you pick 19 years? Because that's how far back the data goes on splitting out these components. The blue, so if you look at the Intermediate Government Credit Index, which is a fairly common index for pension funds to use, either that one or the aggregate index, okay? The blue shows you what percentage of the index was made up of treasuries. The red is how much is made up of government-related securities. Think of Ginnie Mae's, Fannie Mae's, you know, agencies. And the green is corporate bonds. Now, the blue, you see, wow, in 94, it was almost 70%. It came down to almost 35%, and now it's going back up. So why'd that happen? Because we were paying off debt in the 90s as a country. And we were, and so debt was going to corporate, not that, so government debt was going down, corporate debt was going up, okay? And then started in 2001, 2002, government debt went up, corporate debt actually didn't go down much, but as a percentage of the total, became less and less, okay? So that's to give you some idea of, you know, the makeup of what those percentages are. Now, if you go to page two, because this will then lead to the question, well, do you change what you allow them to do? We just took points on there every 5 years to say, okay, so where, what are those actual numbers? And so you can see corporate debt, and I'll start at 2013, which is the bottom right-hand side and work across. Corporate debt of that benchmark, you know, 28.3, 29.2, 36.7, 28, 19. So roughly around, I'm going to average out maybe about 30% on average over that time period. Now, you go to the next page, you might say, well, so what if you relaxed those guidelines a little bit? What would have that meant to the fund? Okay. So we look at, and you'll see in the top part, that sort of lighter blue, what did the Intermediate Government Index do since December 77? You say, why December 77? Because that's when the index started. So we got 30, well, actually it started in 73, but it's 35 years of data. It did 7.6%. The 75, 25, because you now allow your manager to go up to 25. So if they always sat at 25 that whole time period, what did that do? That did 7.8. If you went to 50-50, doesn't mean that they go 50-50. That means they have a latitude to go there. So if they don't like corporates, they can go down to zero. But they could go up to 50 if they want. Okay. More importantly, you would put a max of, you'd say a minimum of 50% in governments and treasuries, because you might allow them to go into asset backs also. That did 8%, and a 40-60 did 8% also. One's really like more like 7.97, the other's 8.03, but they both round to 8. We also looked at 5-year time frames and say, well, Michael, why did you guys do that? Because you want to make sure and say, you might say, well, on average this worked out, but maybe there was some time period where it was absolutely horrible to have more in corporates. Well, actually, you look at those, and there's not a single 5-year time period other than the period from 77 to 82 where it wasn't beneficial to allow more into corporates.
So we could at least go 50-50.
Yeah. Okay. We showed you 40-60, because a lot of times we know if we say 50-50 to somebody, I say, well, let's go 60 or 65. If we show you 40-60, then a lot of times people will say, well, 50-50 looks good. Mm-hmm. And then this shows you if you had $10 million, the last chart is if you had $10 million and you invested that, because it's one thing to say, well, 7.6 or 7.8, well, that's only 0.2%. Well, what does that really mean? Well, over a 20-year time period, each one of those benchmarks, that would have just going from 75-25 to 50-50, that would have added another $1.7 million to the fund, if that's where they went. So would we be comfortable with 50-50? And I would phrase it more of that they need, right now you say they have to have a minimum of 75% in government securities. If you say a minimum of 50%, so that means they couldn't go less than that, that allow them to go into corporates, but also allow them to go into asset backs, which are another type, and mortgages, things like that, which I think would be appropriate to allow them to have some flexibility to go into those areas. So instead of saying you can go up to 50% corporate, I would just phrase it the other way around. So.
On the fixed income, are they, I didn't really look at this, but on the maturities, are they, well, it's 3.9 years, is that correct? And duration at 3.6?
Yes.
So it's not so much intermediate, it's almost, short to intermediate, I guess.
Well, that would be still be considered, because that's the duration, not the maturity. So it, but.
Yeah, well, it's showing 3.9,
yeah.
If I'm reading this right,
yeah.
On maturity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And right that, now, that's what
on
the.
Page 24.
Yeah.
Oh, are you an OPEB? No.
No.
So I guess that's one of the concerns that I would have in that by it was the intermediate term, and I guess we really don't have any guidelines on that, official guidelines.
Well, the guidelines actually.
Them decide on terms or how.
No, actually, the guidelines actually are pretty specific. They're allowed to go plus or minus 25% of the duration of the right now it's the intermediate government index. So if the intermediate government index is 3.6 duration, then they could go down to 2.7 and up to 4.5 in their duration of the portfolio.
Okay. I guess my concern is if rates go up, if the economy continues to improve and rates go up, that we would lose value.
Well,
but with that's not too bad. 3.6 duration, that's not too bad.
It's pretty conservative. Now, I will also tell you one of our other clients just yesterday that Lee went to see. You know, this is an issue not just for yourself. Everybody's talking about this issue. Is okay. So interest. Bonds probably aren't going to give the kind of returns that they've given in the past. So what do we do? and you know, what you don't want to do, I believe, is say, okay, fine, let's get all out of bonds, because then where do you put it? Okay, well, you don't want to go 100% stocks. We saw what happened in 2008. We saw what happened in 2000, 2002. One of our clients, we had suggested, now they're 68% equity, so they're more aggressively invested than you are. But we suggested on this, still leave that 25% on the upside, meaning it could only go to 4.5, but allow the manager to go to half of the duration of the benchmark on a downside. So if they really think interest rates are going to go down, they could lower their duration to 1.8 years. We didn't want to take it all the way down to zero because then you could have an all-cash portfolio. But if that's another possibility, although we didn't put it in here, we just sort of thought of it the other day, but that's something you could do here also, allow the manager more latitude to be more protective if interest rates are, they think interest rates are going to go up.
I kind of like that idea.
Okay.
That would give them leeway if it looks like your rates are heading up. They could invest more in short term,
mm-hmm.
and then we would lose less principal. Of course, these all we are investing in individual bonds too, aren't we? So
yes,
as long as we hold them,
right?
Then we're at least
regardless.
We'll get the
principal
income too.
Yeah,
income.
Yeah, at a low rate. Low rate if rates go up.
Yeah, I mean, you still get the year-to-year volatility as it relates to for actuarial calculations and reporting purposes, but you're going to get much less of it, I think, because of the conservative way than I'd see in an average plan.
I like Dave's idea, because we know for certain after maybe 14, I mean, they're going to, you know, stop the quantitative easing by maybe by then, and be a different world as far as interest rates, correct? Or we don't know when the date is, but I mean, we do know there's going to be eventual increase in rates that are, I mean, interest rates on government bonds to be rising.
I'd say with almost certainty, there's never any certainties in this, but I think it would be a pretty good bet that interest rates are going to go up. We don't know when, and we don't know how much, but and you don't want to be in that game of trying to guess exactly when it is. But it's, you know, you just have to look at the long-term trends, and it's extremely likely. Now, if it's driven because the economy is doing better, well, then hopefully your stocks are doing better then to help offset that. But it's not, there's not, if there was an easy solution, we'd tell you what it is.
Yeah.
But if you like that idea, you know, we did put some language together for your proposed changes. That's okay, and you could add to that. So if you look at the first part under proposed changes, now you'll see the investment policy statement to be determined. I'll get to that in a moment. But for the agreement with Wilmington Trust, right now it says a maximum exposure to the corporate sector of 25%. Corporate bonds must have a minimum rating of A3/A. No corporate bonds may be purchased below the rating above. The second bullet currently says minimum of 75% portfolio must be invested in direct obligations of the U.S. Treasury. The new could say, now we had 40%, but we could put 50. Minimum of 50% of the portfolio must be invested in U.S. government securities. You'd want to change the benchmark from the intermediate government benchmark to the intermediate government credit index. And then you could add the language that says that, and I'll have to pull up the investment policy statement, basically it says that the duration can be, states that it can be no greater than 25% of the benchmark and no less than 50% of the benchmark. Right now it says 25% of the benchmark.
Ratio would be no greater than 25%?
Right, which is what it is now.
Of benchmark and no less than 50%?
50%.
Okay.
And that way allow to go to, you know, in today's market down to 1.8 if they said one it chose to.
So you're removing that whole first bullet and not replacing it. We don't need it. We just
right.
go right into the second bullet.
That's correct.
That's your recommendation anyway.
Yes. And I would change the 40 to 50.
Now, okay, the other 50% in the government, it's treasuries and agencies. It's
yes.
agencies too. It's
so,
not
so
direct
at least
obligation.
The, so okay. at least 50% of the portfolio would need to be in treasury and it's in agencies, right? There's still the limitations. They're not allowed to buy non-investment grade bonds.
Right,
there's a limitation
right.
on how much can be in BAA.
Right,
and
it has
so
ratings
and so forth.
That's a big move for the county, 50%. I mean,
well, they're A or
yeah. I don't feel that it's bad.
A,
I mean,
right,
we've
corporate.
Yeah, grade A and A3. I meant because we started with a fixed income of
yeah.
just treasury obligation. That's as tight as you can get, and then went out to the 25. Opened it to agencies and went out to the 25% corporate. Just, you know, 5 years ago or something, but. I think the way that we're doing it, if we were to expand it, is the correct way to do it, you know, watching the returns and getting a consultant to give us comparison ideas and that kind of thing.
I think the historical comparisons are pretty compelling.
I do, too. I agree with you. I think it's...
So that it is a prudent course. I am a little confused in terms of proposed changes where... In removing the first bullet, I'm reading this that Wilmington Trust could invest in any corporate bonds of any sort, and I don't see any quality. Maybe it's elsewhere.
Yeah, we would want to still keep that minimum rating of A3A at purchase, and not, and they can't go below that rating if we take. I have the policy.
Yeah, you could leave that in there if you want to. I mean, I'll say it's not unusual.
to allow them to go, say, up to 20% in BAA, which is still investment grade. And the benchmark does have, you know, roughly about 20% in BAA, which is still investment grade. So, I mean, if you ask me, I think I would have no problems with allowing that, but if you're not comfortable with that, but I think that's how I would,
We could
But if you're not comfortable with that, then, you know, you might need to take this in steps.
Just take out that first line, maximum exposure 25%, because we're inserting minimum of 50% of portfolio invested in government securities, but leave the corporate bond rating in there.
I agree. I think there should be some limit on the minimum rating.
Right. I do, too. Well, that helps you allow you to go when you go up to 50%. You've got some, you know, comfort level that they're all quality.
Yeah, acknowledging where we've come from.
Right.
That probably is a way to go. I would be comfortable myself going reflective of the index, mm-hmm. putting a pretty tight limit on BAA, which is also investment grade.
Yeah.
But if you feel that for purposes of the council and taking this in measured steps, I wouldn't oppose the idea of keeping that A3A limitation.
Yeah. Just so you know, your investment policy statement does allow up to 15% in BAA. However, Wilmington Trust contract is stricter than the investment policy statement.
We would need a new contract, too. Well,
yeah, it'd just be addendum to that, but
right,
yeah.
Right.
So you can say, as you're presenting this to council, you can say we're not altering the quality of the bonds.
I think I could get that through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They've been very...
have a better feel with it, just going with the A.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Anybody want to make that motion? See if we've got any support? Keep talking about it.
How do people feel about the duration, making that change, where it'd be no less than 50% of the benchmark?
I like it.
Is that an insert we need? Michael, that's not in the investment policy, is it? But we
well. Here's the complication that I haven't quite figured this out yet. You have the investment policy statement, which really is as it relates to the overall plan, okay, and then the guidelines that you do for the investment manager. Doing it in the contract would be an easy thing to do.
Okay.
And I'm still thinking through what we want to do with the investment policy statement and this one. The OPEB's an easy one, too. It's because you have the state doing their things, and how do we combine those two together. So I probably for the moment wouldn't touch the investment policy statement until I figure out how we want to tackle that.
We're better off one-on-one with the investment manager in the contract.
On this issue. Yeah. I think that's how I would tackle this one.
Okay. So that was duration no greater than 25% of benchmark and no less than 50% of benchmark. Do I have that worded right?
Yes.
Okay.
And that should be effective duration.
Effective duration.
I move we recommend amending the Wilmington Trust investment management agreement so that a minimum of 40% of the portfolio must be invested in U.S. government securities, treasuries, and agencies. Corporate bonds must have a minimum rating of A3/A at the time of purchase. No corporate bonds may be purchased below the above rating, and that the duration, the average duration would be no greater than 25% of the benchmark and no less than 50% of the benchmark.
Did you want 40% or 50% in that motion?
Well,
just to be clear, we talked about both.
I think would the 40% give the Well, we were talking about 50%, weren't we?
Yes, we were.
Instead of 40% for U.S. government.
We're at 25.
40% was just something you had there for discussion?
Yeah, we just...
Oh, you had the chart.
Yeah, we just had the charts. We wanted to show you
40
both.
40 or 50. It's,
yeah. 50. Probably just as much, because if we showed you 50, you might have said, well, let's do 65. If we figured if we showed you 40, you might say, yeah, well, 50 looks good.
Why don't we go with the 50 then? 50%, sorry.
Okay, that's okay. I have a motion as read by Mr. Baker on the various proposed changes as discussed. A second.
I think one thing you want to add to it, and to change the manager's benchmark the intermediate government index to the intermediate government credit index.
Okay. I would have done what was okay. So a motion as discussed, make changes as proposed by Pierce Park Group and read by Mr. Baker. I have a second.
Second.
Okay. Let's take a vote. Mr. James?
Yes.
Ms. Burrington?
Yes.
Mr. Lawson?
Yes.
Mr. Leahy?
Yes.
Mr. Baker?
Yes.
And I vote yes. So what I'll do is I'll wrap that up and bring it to council soon and get the contract going for them.
Okay. So to run that issue, right behind that is for the OPEB. Okay. So
is that the same kind of thing?
I'd say same kind of thing there, but we can change the investment policy statement also. It's easier to do that because we don't have to figure out how to integrate that with what the state's doing.
Well, yeah, Wilmington Trust has all the fixed income.
Right.
I think it might be a little bit cleaner if I just say we're amending contracts and changing the policy of one and doing a contract to the other. Until we change both policies at the same time, maybe. I don't know. You know what I mean? Well, I'll be changing the investment policy on one and not on the other.
Well, I think I'd still prefer to do the policy on it because it's pretty, you can tie the two together. Here's the contract with the manager, here's the policy, it's one manager, and we actually want to make sure the policy is consistent
right.
with that. Because the state actually manages to the aggregate index, and it's
right.
just that just.
Okay.
Make a motion that we amend the OPEB investment policy statement to change the domestic fixed income guidelines to 50%. For government and agency investments and fixed income investments, and also amend the Wilmington Trust Investment Management Agreement for OPEB for the same 50% government agency and fixed income investments, as well as change the benchmark to Barclays Intermediate Government Credit Index and change the restrictions regarding duration to average duration to no greater than 25% of the benchmark and no less than 50% of the benchmark.
Okay, I have a motion to amend the investment policy for the OPEB plan, to amend the investment policy and the contract with Wilmington Trust as discussed by Mr. Baker. I have a second. All right. Mr. James?
Yes.
Burrington?
Yes.
Mr. Lawson?
Yes.
Mr. Leahy?
Yes.
Mr. Baker?
Yes.
I vote yes. All right, I'll take that in at the same time. Thank you.
Okay. And I'll go on to the OPEB plan. Okay, go on to the next tab. Fourth quarter, $230,000 gain. Again, net of all investment management expenses, gross return of 1%, a net return of 0.9, and you slightly beat your benchmark. So, but keep in mind, last year, because of all the things we talked about before and the limitations of how you could structure your managers, remember you made those changes, and now we're starting to see some positive,
yeah.
you know,
That's definitely a positive improvement.
That's a positive improvement. So for the year, you gain $1.9 million. I say gross return of 8.9, net return of 8.4, and you have low management expenses of 0.37%.
That's amazing.
That's pretty really low. Low.
Yeah. So, contrast that with the pension, which is, we'll just make it easy. Let's just say it's 20 basis points difference on close to $60 million. You know, that's $120,000 a year. So.
But we have some index funds here, too.
Yeah.
Lower.
That helps. Now, you do have indexing in the state pool also. You know, definitely part of the state plan is index. You know, a lot of the domestic equity is. You added mid-cap value index in December, which added some mid-cap value actually happens to be right now the best performer, and actually over a longer period of times. If you could only invest in just one area, mid-cap value has been the best performer over 10, 20, 30 years. You might say, now, why is that? Well, first off, there's the Goldilocks effect. Not too big, not too small. The biggest stocks, you know, how much bigger? I mean, you could see Apple as well as Apple did. It's come back down. It can only get so big. Same thing with Exxon. Same, you know, they can only grow so much. The small company stocks do well coming out of recession.
Right.
But when you hit recession, that's when they get hit the hardest. The mid-cap stocks, they might get hit, but they're bigger than a small company. So if they get smaller, they're still alive. The small ones, they get smaller, they may not be there anymore. So you have, I'd say, the Goldilocks effect of the mid-cap, and then the value, as I've discussed on many occasions and talked about a little bit today, over time, value has outperformed growth. And you might say, well, for those of you who took finance courses, say, well, why should that be? You know, the more aggressively you invest, you should be rewarded with more return. You should be, but you haven't been. But it's 10, 20, 30, even the studies that go back to the 1920s, the bits and studies, et cetera, value has outperformed growth. And one of the reasons, at least the thinking out there, is that people just get so excited about things like the tech stocks and all that, they just pay too much for them, you know? So, and value stocks, the reason why they're value stocks is you don't pay too much for them. So it's sort of what Warren Buffett does, and that's not necessarily a bad way to look at things. 2012, you had very strong performance by Dodge and Cox and Ridgeworth. You lagged your peer universe due to conservative investment approach at time when markets rewarded aggressive investing. Okay, but still positive, you know, good positive returns. Things to look at: the fixed income guidelines, which we've addressed today, actuarial assumptions, LDI, and GASB 67-68. Well, those are the same things I said on the pension side, didn't I? Okay.
Yeah, I'm pleased with the change and the turnaround and how we've gotten rid of some of the managers based on our constraints and new ones with the OPEB.
Yeah. So I think that's worked very well for you. You know, it took, you had to, as you all know, you had to go through a process and you had to go through, you know, I'll use the term your bylaws or the governance as to how you could do that. But the changes you made the latter part of last year have helped.
Yeah.
In fact, if you go to page 33, this page is called an attribution page. An attribution is to try to attribute as to if you were ahead or behind your benchmark, what caused that? Was it the asset allocation? Was it the managers? So if you're to the right of that line, that means you outperformed your benchmark. If you're to the left, you underperform. If it's the gray, that's the managers. If it's blue, it's your asset allocation. Okay? Since a little bit of the blue is over, you say, well, how'd that happen? Well, you were just a little bit over your 60% allocation in equities, and equities outperformed fixed, so you picked up a little bit there. The big outperformance was both on the equity side and the fixed income side. Your managers added, you know, so that the total outperformance was a little bit over 15 basis points over your benchmark. So go on to page 34. You'll see each of the managers, their rankings, their returns. And we even show their returns and rankings even if you didn't
have them in your portfolio at that point in time, because being that they're mutual funds, we have historical data. But you see on the far right-hand side, we show you where it says since, that's when you hired them. Okay, so that's since they've been in your portfolio. So let's take BlackRock as a starter. BlackRock is a dividend-oriented manager, just like Vanguard Dividend Growth is. Okay, more conservative. Last quarter, they were only up 0.4, ranked a little bit below the average. Keep in mind, one is the highest performer, 99 would be the worst on a percentile basis. For the year, in the 80th percentile, but you look at 3 years and 5 years, 15th and 13th percentile. They're the kind of man. So you say, well, why did they do so well, you know, 3 years and 5 years out? Because in the down markets, they do better. Okay. Now, in a moment, I'm going to point out there's a couple managers you have that do better in the up markets. So that's, I like my sports analogies, but, you know, you do want a couple home run hitters in the portfolio, although you have mainly singles and doubles hitters. Okay. Same thing with dividend growth. As I mentioned earlier, the ones that were more dividend-oriented didn't do as well last year, but still did quite positive. But you've only had them since August, so you've only had them for a quarter. You have the Vanguard Russell 1000 Index. You know, very inexpensive. It should do no more than no less than the index. Same thing with the Mid-Cap Value Index. That was a recommendation we made last year to get a little bit more mid-cap in the portfolio. You can see that one was up 2.9 for the quarter. And actually, if you go to this one page, we have through the end of January report for you. So I go to this just a reference. So for the quarter, and I'll come back to this, for the month of January, you're up 2.9%. Okay. BlackRock up 4.4. The benchmark was 6.5. But you see the big winners in there were the small cap side. The Vanguard Mid Cap Index up 6.7. Ridgeworth Small Cap Value up 7.7. That's just 1 month. Whether they go up or down from there for the rest of the year, well, only time will tell. But what we're seeing is that the small and mid-cap stocks, at least right now, are the ones doing the best. Dodge & Cox continues to do quite well at 5.4, and Harding Loevner up 4.1. Your fixed income was actually down 0.3. Okay. Interest rates went up. Bond values went down, and they went down more than the yield on the portfolio. So, again, this is why we talk about, you know, what are some of the alternatives to try, you know, this trend might start to be occurring.
And Mike, sure. back on
sure.
31.
31, okay.
And the capture ratio, it looks like I think this is not new, but we remain in the worst box we want to be in. Is there anything that we should be taking from that? Any strategic changes or other kinds of actions we should be taking?
So I answer that twofold. One is it's representative of before, and as you know, you were very limited on what you could do in picking of managers because of the process. So you end up picking what you could, and that's when you finally got, you know, the governance change that allowed you to make those changes. So a number of things you have done. So I wouldn't necessarily look at that. If you took the mix, maybe more representative, if you took the mix of what you have now and said, if you had this mix over that time period, what would that look like? We can do that for you and get that to you. I wouldn't change it much, but it does get to an issue that we did want to talk about. I'll touch on it, and we can, you know, next meeting talk a little bit more. This area of what's called real assets, okay? One of the concerns out there is that inflation will rise also, okay? You pour that much money into the economy, okay? Globally, some point in time, inflation will go up. Now, will spike up or will be just a steady trend? And the trends, you know, inflation doesn't like go up for a year and then it goes down. You know, these tend to be longer term secular trends. And what we're seeing is plans are starting to prepare more for that, okay? Because if inflation goes up, what happens? A couple things. Salaries do go up. You know, if inflation, I'll, I mean, I'm remember the 70s inflation's, you know, being 7-10%. Salaries won't go up 1 or 2%. Salaries go up, benefits go up. You know, it's a DB plan. COLAs go up, okay? Indirectly, as inflation goes up, then the premium that you need on fixed income needs to go up, meaning the difference between, you know, the yield and inflation to covering for inflation risk. And so if interest rates go up faster, then bond returns will go down faster. So what, you know, governments are starting to look at is, should you have some of your portfolio that is there sort of, I'll call it inflation-protecting investments, call them real assets. And that's something that I'd like to bring to you to look at. And you might say, well, what are types of real assets? Well, commodities, real estate, TIPS. Those are the primary ones that you think of. That's not to say that you do it or you don't do it, but I think an education on it would be well worthwhile. And then you sometimes, you might look and say, nah, we're not comfortable with that, but you've gone through the process and you've consciously decided not to do that. Or you might look and say, it's not a bad idea. Maybe we'll get our feet wet with it. Maybe we'll put a little bit in there and watch that and see how that works. Or
that part of the equity percent? Or do we have a new category now, real assets?
I'd probably carve it out as a separate asset class.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Probably carve it out of that. Now, the question is, where do you take it from? Do you take it from equity or do you take it from fixed?
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a discussion we'd want to have. You know, most of the times people would take it from both, but right now they're more likely to take it from fixed. You know, so but keep in mind, every organization is different. Every organization's comfort level is different. So, but I think if you'd like me to at the next meeting, just bring an education on it, and then you can look at that. But because
and that's called real assets, because I know we have some investors on the committee that will do some research on their own.
We're especially interested in corn and soybeans.
Yeah. So is the idea, is it real meaning versus a stock, is a company interest real, is like here's your oranges, here's your lemons, here's your commodity.
Sure.
Then real estate, of course.
Yeah.
Tangible.
Yeah, more tangible. Yeah. So commodities,
David.
Real estate, you know. Now, it used to be years ago, you know, if plans invest in it, they might just invest in just one or just the other, you know, just commodities, just currency, just whatever. Now there's funds out there that invest across the board, because one moment in time it might be better to be in real estate, another moment in time it's better to be in commodities. And who's going to make that decision?
So like a mutual fund approach for the commodities.
Exactly.
With a whole bunch of different stuff, so you're balanced within it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Going back to what you mentioned before in the pension plan, that we're currently around 60% invested with a state, and you mentioned at some future point maybe taking a look at that, but you think that's something to think about over the next year or two, maybe bringing it down a little bit and looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily rush to do something, because what I don't want to do is, as I say, they didn't have as good a year last year, but I don't think you should be precipitous about making a change just because last year wasn't as good. It wasn't a terrible year.
Nothing dramatic.
Right. Just,
yeah.
It may be just as you put cash flow in, or if you have to take cash out, if you take cash out, maybe you take that from the state, and if you put cash, if you have net contributions in, maybe it goes to the other areas. Just maybe move it toward a 50-50 balance down the road. But I think the bigger issue is looking at these other things, such as, you know, real assets. And the other thing might be is looking at your international targets.
Yeah.
Okay. You have
15.
Right. Let's see here what your target is right now on international.
I like the Oppenheimer Global Fund. That's a good fund there for international.
That's in our NACO.
Yeah, we have a NACO.
So you're 12% targeted for international. I'd say most of our plans that are at 60% equities are at 14%. Our 65% plans are more like 16%, and they're all thinking about maybe even moving that up some. Keep in mind, international is about 52% of the world markets now. Okay. Now, international over time has had more volatility than the U.S. markets, so you'd have to, you know, you'd have to weigh that issue. But if the drivers of the world growth in the future are going to be more than emerging markets, do you get some more exposure into the emerging markets, you know? And do you do that actually through these real asset funds? You can get, you know, I mean, they could have emerging market debt, they could have, you know, things like that. So why don't I bring some ideas for you, and you can, you know, all of them I think would be good ideas, and then you can pick and choose, well, this we're comfortable with, this we're not, and see if there's any changes. But that might be one other area is you know, maybe nudging up your international exposure a little bit, you know.
Along those lines, it might be good if you had, you know, a profile of similar municipalities and kind of profile of any trends that you see there in this regard. Mm-hmm. If we were, for instance, the Lone Ranger, the only such fund where there was no no real assets in our investment policy, I think that's something we'd want to know.
Oh, I do too. Yeah. Right.
That's another thing Warren Buffett likes is physical, real-world assets.
He does.
It's one of his one of the things he explores when he invests, among other things, value companies. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he likes physical assets, like that train. I forget which one it is, but he bought the train system, one of the bigger ones.
Right, yeah.
He just buys the whole company,
not just a couple stocks, shares.
Now, I will tell you, most plans of your size, whether it's each of the individual plans or the aggregate, probably still don't have real assets, but it's something very topical that a lot of them are looking at. I'd say most of them do have a higher target to international equities. That doesn't mean that's what you do, but it's a data point so you can at least, you know, it's human nature not to want to be too different than the rest of the group. So we can give you some idea of what we see among our client base, but also ones that aren't our client base. You know, in some of these databases you subscribe to, what do we see, you know, average allocations to these different.
Any other questions, Mr. Shannon? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. John Lessel's here from Florida for our pension committee. He is representing Aon, who is our actuary, and we're going to talk about the timely subject of the assumptions on the rate of return for our actuary report, what options that we do have, and I'm sure we have questions for him, and anything that's related to actuary. So, welcome.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here. I had the pleasure of staying at the Brick last night, which was really lovely and so much better than all my other traveling experiences. So, very nice. I actually, thinking about the fact that this is my first time here, I thought maybe before I start talking about what I'm here to talk about, maybe some of you have some questions or something that you've been dying to ask the actuary. I mean, I won't be offended if you don't, but I thought I might just give you that opportunity.
Well, it's, you know, it's been a big topic of conversation around the county with the pension committee and the council that the 8% assumed rate of return is just not good to use anymore because of the investments, and we hear it in the news and you hear it everywhere. So that's really what I'm hearing. I don't know what anybody else.
Yeah, I'm hearing like they're going to 7.5% or you know, in that vicinity, that more real world, because they don't think 8% will be a realistic return, you know, going forward, you know, in the foreseeable future. So they're trying to be more realistic, and they're
does
going
everybody
like
have this?
Mid-sevens.
I don't mean to interrupt because it's important.
Need copies?
Yeah. Dave, do you have one, Karen?
Mm-mm, I don't.
Nancy? Get about 5 or 10, Todd, yes. Because I think this is a mock. But we are.
Yesterday's email.
Excuse me?
They were attached to
yeah, they were in the email. Middle of this.
Well, that. There's the 7.5.
Oh, no.
Do you know that, Michael? Did the state drop theirs? I could check that out.
Maybe it was in that Oracle. talking about it or something.
Discussing.
Well, that definitely is, you know, the number one topic on my agenda today was to talk about that.
Are there any other issues that you see that would affect maybe regulatory issues or that would affect the contributions that the county would be required to make to the fund?
You're probably in pretty good shape. You may be thinking about the GASB 67-68. That probably is not going to have a very big impact on you all, primarily because you are already actuarially funding your plan. Okay, in other words, when we give you a the required contribution, that is recognizing all of the liability, and you've been more than meeting that, which means that under the new GASB rules, you'll be measuring the liability on a long-term rate of return expectation like you currently are. There are many governmental entities, however, and they're probably the ones you've been hearing about in the papers and so on, where they don't even fund what the actuary says they should be.
Thank you.
And so if their practice is not to fund toward the entire liability, then the liability is going to have to be split into two pieces, and the part that they're not funding is going to have to be measured not on a long-term expected investment return assumption, but on a basically the cost of money for governmental bonds. So they'll be measuring that down in the 3 or 4% range, which means it's going to be a much larger liability. And when you do contribute or determine a contribution on that basis, it's going to be a much larger figure. So there's potentially a big impact on those plans that have not been soundly funded, conservatively funded, but you guys will be in good shape there.
Because we're launching into this for the first time since I've been sitting here, could you at a high level just discuss how actuarially accrued liability is determined? Mm-hmm. How is that number determined? Okay. And then how is the minimum required contribution then determined?
Sure. Good topics. It's also interesting to know something about that because different entities actually measure different kinds of liability. And a lot of times they all get picked up in the papers and they tend to assume that they're all the same thing, but they're not. Okay? That's part of the methodology that it's used for a specific plan. Your plan, the pension plan, uses what's called the projected unit credit method for determining the liability. And basically what we do there is we look at the we project the expected benefit payouts that everybody is expected to get based on how we think their salary is going to grow and how much service they have and so on. And then all of that is discounted at some assumed rate, the 8% in your case right now. And then it's it's allocated to the time periods over the active employee's working career in pieces that represent the fact that benefits cost more the closer you get to retirement. That's what's called the PUC normal cost. So it's that whole liability is allocated to all the time periods over the employee's career. If the employee is late in his career, it's going to be a large piece allocated to that year. Early in his career, it'll be a small piece because they have a long ways to go to retirement. And when you spread that over a whole group, you know, it kind of tends to even out. But that's the allocation process. And then all those pieces that get allocated to time in the past, that is your actuarial accrued liability for your plan. And that's what gets compared to the assets that you actually have in the trust. The 1 year's piece, the current year's piece, that's the normal cost. That's part becomes part of your required contribution for that year. And then the other part of your required contribution is to make up for the shortfall, if there's any difference between that actuarial accrued liability and the assets. So if they were equal, there'd be no amortization piece. If they were not equal, if there was a loss or an underfunding, which yours currently is about $11 million the last time we measured, then that piece also is being amortized just like a mortgage, really. And a portion of that is added to the current year's contribution requirement. It is also worth noting, when you start comparing to other government entities, that amortization method varies a lot. Different systems use different methods. The method that you're using is called level percentage open, which means that every year we look at the entire unfunded amount and we determine, well, what if you started amortizing that all over again over 30 years and not as a level dollar amount, not like a level mortgage, but as an increasing amount that's expected to increase each year at the same rate that your overall payroll increases. And the assumption here has been 3.5% payroll growth. So what that actually means is it's like these mortgages where you're not even paying down on the principal in the early years. It's exactly the same thing here. The amortization piece that goes into your minimum required contribution is actually doesn't cover the 8% interest on the unfunded for that year. Your practice has been to contribute more than the minimum required, and actually it seems like a lot of years you've contributed more than enough to, you know, to fully cover the interest and to work down the principal a little bit as well. But there are other municipalities that use other methods, which they may, instead of having it as an increasing percentage, they may use a level percentage. They may not use 30 years, they may use a shorter period. They may not start over again every year, but have separate amortization tables for each year's loss or increase in the unfunded. They have a separate table for each one. A lot of differences that way.
If we have less employees than we did a few years ago, I wonder if that all helped offset this liability.
I don't know. We just have to come up and identify yourself.
Because I can answer that, and I have been a question for him because I'm concerned about that.
Well, do you want to finish your question, and then we'll take...
Well, that was basically, I was just wondering if having
We've gone up since then.
We have had, I guess we have had some COLAs, but not with less than 3.5%, and maybe that helped offset the losses like everybody had in 2008.
Definitely, yeah. Of course, most people are having cutbacks in their staffing and so on, too. So most entities are in the same boat. They've been suffering large losses because of investment experience. But then, you know, the whole economy and everything is resulting in smaller salary increases, smaller growth in workforce and so on. And to the extent any of those, you know, we make assumptions. The 8% is an assumption about a long-term investment return. We also have assumptions about how our salary is going to grow. how's that payroll going to grow that we use to do the amortization piece, the 3.5%? We have assumptions about when people are going to retire. What's their likelihood of terminating? How long are they going to live? All of those kinds of things. And to the extent in every year we remeasure, you know, we start with up-to-date data and see what's happened. And to the extent that, for instance, salaries didn't increase as much as the salary scale assumption, then that is a gain for the plan, and it does help offset the investment return loss. Same thing for all of the other assumptions.
Okay. Gina, do you want to?
I'm Gina Jennings, the finance director appointee.
Oh.
just to go with what Dave had said, I did an analysis for the last 5 years back, and we've had a loss in our payroll, 4.9% actually, 4 years ago. So that 3.5 assumption we definitely want to look at, because we haven't, the highest we went was 2.4%. That was 2 years ago, and we did a 1.8% increase this year, so we're not close to 3.5.
That's one of the things on a different thing that we change. You don't change that every year just because it works. We have another thing about our assumptions that we're going to talk about, and that's one of the things on here is payroll growth and what assumptions we're using versus an actual.
Just going on with what we were talking about, the actuary accrued liability, I noticed it increased almost $7 million from last year to this year, and you're talking about how why it could. I just wondered if you knew specifics as why ours would have increased so much compared to the previous years.
The cover letter.
This was our financial statements.
Yeah. But the full actuarial report has a discussion in the front of it, and it identifies the components. There was a component last year. We in accordance with what has become pretty much common practice in my own firm's policy, we adopted a new mortality table last year that projects future improvements in mortality.
Okay.
And that was one of the driving components for that, a portion of that.
Is this the new?
No, we don't have the new.
Oh,
this
okay.
is 12. Because they're going to run the 13, it's going to be run on all these scenarios. And then we're going to have to decide at some point at, if we want to take it from 8 down to anything else. So what we're going to do is run it, all the different assumed rate of returns that we've been talking about to see what it does to our contribution, all before the budget. So I guess that's what you guys will be working on.
Water and sewer will pick up a good percentage of this, too. That's not quite all
aromatics.
General fund.
Right.
It helps bear the burden a little bit, you know, I guess.
I guess is in following up with what Gina said, is it worth taking a look at that 3.5%, not only looking at the investment returns, but also
yes.
looking at the growth in mm-hmm. payroll?
Right.
Is that,
yeah.
I guess
They're
it's been pretty static.
It has.
A few years that was reduced, and then there hasn't been a lot of.
That was one of my three topics for today.
Okay.
One topic was the investment return assumption. One topic is looking at all of the actuarial assumptions, the demographic assumptions, including the 3.5%. And then one is the cost study that Susie and I have been talking about, where this county's interested in looking at the impact of allowing members to go beyond either the 25-year cap on service or the 30-year cap.
To bring the members up to date, we have been tasked to look at in an ordinance, the years of service was capped for later employees, medics and dispatchers at 25 and everybody else, regular employees, at 30. So they're going to put together, if we open that cap back up, that you got credit for your years of service past 25 or 30, what that cost would be, so that council and administration can have it to make that decision to change that. That's what you wanted, right, Todd? That we want to look at that.
The cap was put on
2001.
2001.
But we've had some questions about it, you know, about what's the value of our, would employees stay longer, less attrition in needed departments, paramedics specifically, if they got value past 25 years and then we are not hiring.
We want to know the numbers before.
Oh, we want to know the number,
make
yeah.
any kind of decision, what kind of liability comes along with that decision.
Sure.
Are the mortality tables national or are they localized?
Mortality tables are because, you know, very few entities are large enough to have meaningful experience on their own. Mortality pretty much comes from recommendations from the Society of Actuaries. And they publish tables and they include mortality improvement scales that get used with these. Couple of years ago in the private sector, the IRS rules finally mandated mortality improvement be used for all private sector plans. Our own firm has adopted that as a policy for all of our clients too, even if they're not in the private sector. So yes, that's the answer.
So all those beef barbecues here locally, we don't need to worry about that. We're going to live as long as anybody else.
So that kind of takes us through the investment return assumptions. I guess we really have to run the numbers to see what we're, how much we're increasing our contribution.
Yeah, the one page sheet that you have in front of you, I just gave Susie that. That was for something that we did for another client, and I wanted to let you see that this is what I'm proposing we'll do for you all. Basically, we'll look at what the required contribution is, what the actuarial accrued liability is, and what the vested benefits are. At 8%, we'll also look at it at 7.5%, and we can give you those intermediate values by simple interpolation. So that'll give you a feel for what's going to happen to those numbers if you were to change the assumption. As I mentioned before, you folks have been contributing more than the required contribution. And so in some ways, the minimum that we come up with for you is not relevant. I mean, you've based on your own budget and surplus and what have you, you've been able to contribute more, which is why your plan is in so much better shape than the typical government plan these days. So in some ways that minimizes the importance of the assumption as it affects your contribution, because what's going to happen is, you know, you'll have a higher required contribution, but if you've been funding more than that anyway, it just means that the differential has decreased. But certainly measuring the accrued liability, the actual accrued liability, is something you'd like to have be accurate or, as you know, be a good estimate of what you think it should be. And this assumption is, as Susie mentioned earlier, this is a long-term kind of an assumption. When I first started in the business back in the 70s, almost all pension plans were based on 5 or 6% in that range. And starting somewhere in the 80s, when things began to really take off, they very rapidly increased. And certainly by, you know, the second half of the 80s, everybody was using 8% in the private sector and the public sector. And it's continued pretty much around 8%. I mean, you know, a very tall and narrow distribution curve around centered on 8%. But then in the last, maybe 10 years, there's begun to be a focus from different sectors on, well, you know, as you said, maybe 8% just isn't achievable anymore. The world has changed. We can't do that. A lot of that was driven by a feeling, particularly in the private sector, that says, you know, when these plans terminate, you can't settle at 8%. You can't go out and buy annuities at 8%. And the private sector has pretty much exclusively gone now to using a return assumption based on corporate bond rates, because that's basically what drives annuity rates for buying annuities from an insurance company if you wanted to terminate your plan and settle it. And so that's basically what the IRS requires on the private sector. And the accounting profession also, I think, with an eye to the fact that plans terminate readily in the private sector, started requiring that in the financial reporting requirements as well. In the public sector, it's been a bit slower, and I think naturally so, because there's a recognition that pension plans in the public sector are not so likely to terminate. They're more of a long-term commitment that's here. The government's going to stay. You're not going to close up shop. Although we hear of examples where that's starting to change too, with the municipalities that have gone bankrupt and so on. So there is definitely, although slower and with some mitigating reasons, we're seeing a lot of interest in looking at using a lower investment return assumption for measuring your obligations. Michael's clients, he and I were talking before the meeting, and actually quite a few of his apparently have already gone down from 8%. Mine have mostly been talking about it. Not too many of them have. I've had one that went from 8.3 to 8. They have not really taken the step, although they're all looking at it, like from the schedule, and may do so soon. Florida Retirement System, which I'm a little more familiar with because I'm living down there, they're at 7.75. And last year there was a law passed in Florida. All the governmental plans in Florida, they're not required to use 7.75, but they're required to disclose what their vested liability would be at 7.75. It's something we've had to add to the reports. So there's definitely focus in that direction. I already talked about GASB 67 and 68 for the plans that aren't being actuarially funded, how they have to now measure and disclose at even, governmental bond rate basis. So definitely the thing to do, and this is what we're proposing as a means to help give you the impact, and we'll be able to do that for the January 1, 2013 valuation, which will be your 13 to 14 fiscal year.
And then we'll just want to get the cost of the change in the years of service.
Right. Item number two will be, we'll determine that cost. It's a little trickier than just taking the cap off in the computer program and saying, okay, people can work longer than 25 years or 30 years, because right now we've had an assumption that people are going to retire. At least the medic, we're going to retire if they're minimum age of 55. But as soon as they reach that 25-year cap, we were assuming that they were going to retire. If that cap's not going to go on, be in place, they're going to work longer. So we're going to need to make an adjustment in that assumption. And, of course, if people work longer, they aren't going to collect their pension as much. So that's an offsetting cost. So costs increase because they'll get more credit service. They'll decrease because they're not going to collect as long. And so we have to put all that together to determine the impact for you.
There's two different percentages also on the pension calculation. I don't know if that's something that needs to be factored in.
Oh, no, we do that, the 1.66 and the 2.
Because of the 25 and 30.
Yeah.
The constant 50 or 60.
50, for the months.
Looked at for people over 25 years.
Yeah. It shouldn't be both.
I should add that there's a discussion beyond the 25-year cap and also expand that to all employees for 30-year. So not just our 12-hour shift folks, but in countywide.
But retire at 25 years?
No, lift the cap at 30. So if you work from 30 to 31, there would potentially be an increase in your...
Oh, yeah, that's what we're going to do that too. Both of them, so that we're consistent. We wouldn't just do that for 25-year employee, or just for two groups of people.
But you would, you're assuming that the formulas would stay the same for each?
Well, that would be would have to be a suggestion.
Maybe that's the way we look at it now, just because that's what we're used to. I would assume they...
I don't know if the formula would change. You know, the formula that we use to calculate pension?
With the multiplier.
The multiplier, yeah. If we're going to open it up, would we have to look at that too?
Well, that would be a different study, I think. If you wanted, we could look at that, but...
Where that comes from?
It's the years.
Where is the interest or pressure on that coming?
The idea was that someone could, like a paramedic or dispatcher, could retire with 25 years and basically receive a pension of roughly 50% of their average salary, where for other county employees it's 30 years.
Right.
To get
no,
to the 50%.
I think he's using, the multiplier that we use on the calculation.
That's what it's based on.
So
the service.
Yeah, the constant 60 is based on working for 30 years.
Right.
If you're working 25 years, you're still putting in the same number of hours.
Right. Right.
Because they have a 12-hour day.
Right.
But our analysis, we look at each person and we know which group he's in, and we use the right formula for that person to project his benefit or her benefit.
But the analysis that you're doing now, this is only effective 2001 going forward for those employees with a cap. Anyone that was hired previous to 2001, there is no cap.
Right. And we have that all all programmed in there. So
pre-2001, so most of the original, a lot of the paramedics that were
they're approaching it.
They don't have the cap
now? They do not.
Okay.
I guess you're thinking for hiring purposes, or so they don't have the cap anyway. So
no,
we talked about that.
Yeah, it's more for a
recruitment,
retention type thing for those newer employees that come in
after 2001 don't have the cap. Okay, and the other thing that we wanted to just briefly touch on and get your opinion, John, is what options are out there to tighten up the defined benefit plan. We've talked about that before, driving people, freezing it, extending the vesting, offering another type of defined contribution plan where employees could contribute if, they want to leave, they take that with them, all those kinds of things. And this would probably be just a general question of what are you seeing, Michael, if you want to chime in. We get that question a lot, too.
Sure.
What
mm-hmm.
else can we do to make this plan less expensive on the budget?
Seeing all kinds of different studies, all kinds of different ideas. At one extreme, we see no change for existing employees, but a new tier of benefits, lower-level benefits for new hires. That, of course, because you don't have very many new hires, doesn't have much cost impact at first. And so in those cases, we show the cost impact like 20 or 30 years down the road. We are seeing the vesting you mentioned. The vesting tends to not be a big cost item, so changing that by a couple of years tends to have little effect. Now, making a change that gets people to retire later and not collect a pension for as many years, It's the same thing like you hear about in Social Security. That's a pretty big cost savings. So any way you do that, either by what you're talking about, taking the caps off on the service or raising the minimum required retirement age or anything that has that kind of an effect, I've seen that done. I've seen some interest in delaying the COLA, that the COLA doesn't begin immediately upon retirement, but it's delayed 3 years, 5 years, something like that. Employee contributions.
Right, we've talked about
most
that.
Most governmental plans have employee contributions.
Even on ones such as this?
Yes, all of these changes, you know, that bring that there are multiple issues there, or there are issues there of what, you know, what is the legal requirement as far as the employees, you know, if they're hired under certain plan provisions, what rights do they have to stay with those provisions? My experience has been like the delay in the COLA has been more successful as being something that can be taken away, especially for you all, because your whole approach has always been that that's an additional feature that you retained the right to take away. Employee contributions, a lot of plans have raised employee contributions. Florida Retirement System started it recently. And that's working its way through the courts. But a lot of times, you know, if employees truly understand the tough straits that a pension plan is in, they might be willing to begin to contribute something. And that hasn't seemed to be as difficult a change to do as, for instance, to lower the multiplier.
Are you seeing increased employee contributions on the existing and new, or just moving forward on the new?
On the existing, yeah.
Well, that would give you your bang, because it would take forever to trickle in, new employees as slowly as we hire. But yeah, are you seeing that too?
I'm seeing some push toward that. You know, in Pennsylvania, you have in the state constitution, and the benefits basically are protected, and there was a court case as to, does that allow the state to come and get the existing employees to put more money in, or is that changing their benefits? And it's the feel, I'm not sure if that's actually been opined upon, but it might be working its way through the court, but I think generally there's a real issue as to whether they can even force the existing employees to put more money in because of the protection under the state constitution. I'm hearing, interesting enough, and I mentioned this partially because you're from Tampa, but I was a speaker at a conference in D.C. about 5 years ago, and I wasn't opining on whether it was a good idea or not, but I was mentioning that we're seeing some talk about moving toward D.C. plans for municipal plans. And one of the firefighters from Tampa stood up and said, "You do that, and I'm not coming in to save you."
What do you mean?
I said, you really have a calling, don't you? But
what do you mean moving to DC plans?
Defined contribution plans, like a 401k type plan.
DC.
So yeah, I happen to be in DC talking about DC.
Sorry.
Sorry to confuse things. I do know, as you know, we deal with municipal plans, but a lot of county plans, a lot of them are in Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, each year they decide whether they're going to grant a COLA or not. And most of them are not granting COLAs now.
To
the pensioners. And that is a big, if you work through the numbers, mm-hmm. that's a big, big cost to the annual ARC.
Well, Rob, my issue with that is if we can afford it, I think it's just not right. You know, I just think there's a benefit, there.
Well, county taxes,
if your budget's not struggling to be balanced.
What'd you say, Jeff?
I mean, the county taxes are really very modest. I mean, if they were like the Chicago or something where you're being taxed to death, in order to support a bureaucracy, it'd be different. But us with a kind of a modest amount of county tax, I think we could sort of afford to least continue the COLA, then, you know.
I do too, because I think we have had so much positiveness and surplus. I think it sends a message that is counterproductive to what we have. You know what I mean? Where we're not doing it anywhere else.
Yeah. And I wasn't suggesting changing. No, just asking what we see out there. I do see some talk about either, I think you mentioned a number of these, you know, possibly either lowering the benefit formula,
right,
and then having a DC plan so you combine the two of those,
right,
or cash balance plans, which are sort of a combination of the two. You know, we see that, which doesn't put as much liability upon the county, but it doesn't, you know, the problem with moving to an all DC plan we see in the corporate world is that, you know, people aren't saving enough money and they don't invest. If they're able to direct their investments, their average return of a 401k participant is about 4 percentage points lower than what the corporation does with it. Now, what some people don't realize is that you can have DC plans and the employer still invests in it. It doesn't have to be employer-directed investing. But I guess my point is that I don't know that you want to move from here all the way to over here, because then a lot of times people don't have enough money to live their retirement and dignity, you know, and that's you know.
I mean, if you're making $30,000 a year and then we go to, you know, change the pension plan, I mean, how much money could they even contribute?
Right.
I mean, the county will put some money in, I know that. You'll have that riding, but the employee match, I mean, it could be non-existent. I mean, you know, you're talking about a clerical person who's been there a while. You know,
and we have lower salaries than norm. And if you were going to do the mean, our mean's probably 36 or 38. We did it a while ago. That's not a lot of money to expect them to have a half. Right now, what they get is half that in their pension if they stay the retirement. So I agree with Jeff on that.
Well, just a voice out of the private industry. You know, my little pension is fixed, no COLA, and nothing close after 30 years of service to 50% of salary. So just looked at from the taxpayer standpoint, I know that Sussex County has been very prudent and is very healthy, and its employees, I think, ought to share in the benefit of prudent fiscal practices over years. But just looked at from the private sector,
yeah,
these benefits look very generous.
Yes.
So
true.
I think you just need to recognize that the
yeah,
private sector would characterize these as very generous.
And that's where some of the push and the questions are coming from. But, you know, I'm guessing your salary structure is probably a lot different than our salary
yeah,
structure for what even the higher administrative positions pay.
I think one advantage of having an option, a defined contribution for new employees, would be some employees may not plan on being there 8 years.
Right.
And if they're not, at least they can take something with them, you know, that they...
Transportability.
Yeah, they can
yeah,
switch it over to
yeah,
an RA or something, but if they're not vested. But, I mean,
just,
you know, one time we had talked about possibly having that as an option for new employees,
right,
but our salaries typically are lower, county salaries typically are lower than state or private industry.
And Kent and Newcastle both contribute, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
All the employees.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's cleaner.
Yeah. Now, some of them are grandfathered in, so depending on, just like the state of Delaware, when you're hired, that's what your percentage
they didn't
is.
Take it. Right, but all pay something.
Mm-hmm.
All.
Yes.
All the employees.
Yes.
Oh, obviously, we're.
Well, the state is 3%.
I think it went to 5% last year.
5%
for new hires.
For new hires.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And there's like over six. Is it over like $6,000 in salary
yes,
or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, once you hit that, that's when your taxes start coming, your contributions start coming out. And
unfortunately, to see any big changes, you have to do something like that, because on just new employees, there's just not enough to see anything. So it's a.
But if you eventually you would get it, you would see it.
Right.
Eventually, yeah.
When we made some of the other changes to the pension fund,
right,
it didn't have much effect initially,
right,
but gradually it does.
It does.
Any other questions?
The third topic that I had on the agenda is the actuarial assumptions, doing the experience study, looking at the 3.5%. And I have given Susie a proposal that we do that, looking at retirement rates, termination rates, the 3.5%, salary scale, salary increases, and also the, which one am I forgetting? Oh, marital assumption, because your plan, if a participant is married and dies after he started his pension, the spouse gets the 50% of that benefit provided. In a lot of plans, the member has a choice. He can elect spousal protection, but it's done by reducing the participant's monthly benefit, an actuarial amount, so that for the plan, it's indifferent which the employee elects. It's called actuarial equivalence. But your plan has what's called a subsidized death benefit, in that the spouse protection is there without an election by the member, and there's no decrease in the member's benefit to provide that protection. So as a result, the assumption about how many people are married can have an impact, and your assumption has been 50%, which I think we want to try to take a look at that and see how accurate that is, and possibly make a change there, as well as on these other assumptions that I mentioned. The best practice nowadays, this hasn't always been true, but nowadays the best practice is to do an experience study maybe every 5 years or so, which basically is a process of going back, looking at all of the actual data, all the experience, and comparing that to the assumptions. We would say, okay, if your plan had operated according to the assumptions, how many people would have, say, retired at each age? And we compare that to how many actually retired at each age. And then I'll make a recommendation if I think that we should tweak those rates, to maybe increase them or decrease them or whatever. And we'll do that for all of these assumptions that we study. And even if we don't end up changing something, at least then you have a basis, a justification for why we're using the assumptions that we are using. Mortality, we already talked about that. Usually that, we just use the national standards for that. But other things like salary experience, when people retire, when they terminate, how many are married, that's something that does tend to differ from group to group. So it's something that we want to make more specific to your group.
If you look at the number of people retired, I think over the last few years, you've got to take into account there were 3 limited early retirement options offered to employees, which spiked the number.
Sort
of the attrition process of
reducing good point.
The number of staff.
I wasn't
and
aware
layoffs,
of that.
That was the
okay.
one of the things we did.
Okay. Well, that's good. And we definitely never.
The sort of a
yeah.
bump.
Yeah. We definitely don't just, you know, be a slave to the numbers. You know, we want to look at the numbers as a starting point, but then we have to use judgment as far as you know, whether we really want to make a change here or not, what's our expectation in the future. You know, it's just like your investments. You know, past performance is no guarantee of what's going to happen in the future, and so it becomes a collaborative process. We prepare the numbers, I may make some recommendations, but ultimately it's cooperative between all of us as to what assumptions we think are appropriate to use going forward. And one of the things, like we've talked about the 3.5%, I have no doubt that for the last 5 years, you probably haven't been increasing 3.5%. But we have to remember where that's being used. I mentioned that that's the only place that 3.5% is used is in that amortization schedule, which is a 30-year schedule. So are we prepared to say 15, 20 years from now, we're not going to be back up to 3.5%? So it's a combination of looking at statistics and also making judgments about the future. Question here.
I was actually going to ask you that related question on that about the 3.5%, and you answered it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Now, we might want to make a change there just out of conservatism, you know, rather than have this, you know, this increasing mortgage that I described where you're not even covering the interest.
Yes.
I have some plans that do that, and I have some that don't. They do the level dollar amount. That's inevitably, those tend to be the more conservative ones and the better funded plans, and it might be something you all might want to do, whether the past history supports it or whether you really think that's going to be true for the next 30 years or not, you may still want to do that.
May I ask you a question? Sort of my impression that typically actuaries like to see the spread between the return assumption and the salary increase assumption not to be too wide, because obviously the higher the return assumption you use and the lower the salary increase assumption you have, then the better you look, but it may not reflect, what's really going on. Is that part of your thinking here? What is that spread? What's the maximum spread you usually like to see between the two of those?
I'm not so sure that we have a hard and fast maximum spread. I think what you're referring to is there's a recognition that those things, that investment return and individual salary increases, there are common components to that. Obviously, there's inflation. They affect investments and they affect salaries. So those kinds of things, so there should be some correlation in how they change. Just general productivity, improvements in the country, that's going to be a component of investment return. It's also a component of what salaries are, what individuals are paid in their compensation packages. So normally, you wouldn't want to have a huge difference between those, the salary scale assumption and the investment return assumption. But you might make it a small differential, again, out of conservatism. I have some plans that they use a 6% salary assumption with their 8% investment return, knowing that they're not getting 6% these days, but they're also not getting 8% these days, year after year either, so they feel that that's being conservative. Another thing you got to be careful of with salary increases, I've seen employers say, well, we've had no cost of living in salaries for the last 3 years, so we should have no salary increase. Well, you got to remember another component there is merit increases and that sort of thing. But also inevitably, once the economy turns around, there's pressure to make up for that lack of cost of living increases for a while. And again, remember, our assumptions are very, very long term. We're projecting what people are going to have their benefits based on when they retire 10, 20, 30 years from now. And if there's a likelihood those lost cost of living adjustments being made up in the future, don't really want to change the assumption now because we have this long-term perspective.
One question, I don't know if this is for you, John, or more for you, Susie, and that is in this whole area of funding adequacy, however the assumptions turn out to be, mm-hmm. Are there external regulatory or other kinds of issues that we need to concern ourselves with? For instance, bond rating agencies or our auditors or others who opine on the adequacy of the pension reserves, et cetera. And, you know, what have they been saying? And what would their views be of the various courses of action open to us? And, you know, should we be aware of those issues?
Yeah, absolutely. On the bond rating, it is a complete package. And when they do look at your financial statement, your pension and how well it's funded, is definitely goes into their calculation of your rating. We don't do a lot of public bonds. We just did an issue a year ago to refinance, and we don't have any general fund debt, and we're kind of lucky that way. But, you know, it is a factor. There is a lot of detail in our CAFR financial statements of pension disclosures, pages of it. So it's important to somebody when they read it. Mostly bondholders.
And you may be aware of Moody's this last year came out with a statement about how they're going to start. They've come up with some simple rules of thumb for taking whatever is reported in the actuarial report and adjusting it to current market rates. So even if you're using an 8% assumption or whatever, they've figured out a way that they're going to adjust that to current corporate bond rates and determine an unfunded on that basis for, you know, for rating purposes.
Should get a better rating, I mean, a more accurate rating, perhaps, by using that method, correct? I mean, we've had, like, cases of some companies in the past, like around 2007, being like an A or a AA-rated bond, and then the company gets in trouble, you know, and they're not really a AA-rated company because partly because of their liabilities and other things, they, you know. So, I mean, that's kind of good to hear, I think, that the bond rating agency would take that into, you know, consideration, you know, kind of get better, more accurate ratings, maybe. My unlearned opinion. just thinking.
Any other questions for John? Thank you, John, for coming in.
My
and
pleasure.
I'll be in touch with you and on this study. It's been a long day. I don't want to keep you guys any longer. You got the letter, the email, the meeting dates?
Yes.
Uh-oh, you didn't?
Yes.
You can, Nancy can send that to me.
Yeah, okay, so that we know the next four. And I won't be here after the April 30th, and I'm really sorry. I might come in attendance, though.
When's it?
May
when's
1st.
The next
it's in May.
Oh, it's in
May 16th.
Yeah, so complete confidence in Gina. She's wonderful.
Everybody appreciates everything you've done, too.
Anyway, I just, you know, I might come just to listen, yeah, just see what's going on.
Doing a good job with the committee. And
thank you.
You had a lot more money. And
that was it. I'll take credit for that. Yeah.
And investments have been done overall pretty well.
Yeah. Well, we have made a lot of changes in the last 5 or 6 years to kind of formalize it all and put it on a track to consultant and pensioners coming back. So
I know you've done a very good job.
Oh, thank you.
And others. Certainly to be appreciated.
Anything else?
What she was talking about that you just mentioned, you saved, how much, what was the savings on that bond refinancing?
Oh, like $7 or $8 million.
Yeah.
On a $62 million, yeah.
County sewer districts on that refunded mainly state and federally funded bonds. It really saved the county a lot of money that you all did.
That was perfect timing. I mean, we'll never see rates like that again because it's impossible to go any lower. That's tremendous to lock that rate in and save all that money. It's good.
Any other comments?
You had an item four on here?
Which was additional business? Yeah, I think we kind of hit the goals.
Okay.
Through what Michael was talking about of what he's going to do next week. Unless anybody has, or next week, next time, the different types of investing to kind of look, add something to our portfolio. I don't know if anybody has any other goals. Can email me. I'll put it on the agenda. You can always email me and I can get something on the agenda. You want to talk about it.
What if you're not here?
Yeah.
I'll be, well, we can work on the agenda before May 1st, so. All right, meeting adjourned.
Good, thank you.
My last time.